I would like to tell you a story. Knife Talk is sponsored by Evenheat, the manufacturers of the finest knife treat ovens available. Find your next heat treat oven at evenheat-kiln.com.
How's it going, everybody, and welcome to another episode of Knife Talk. Where we talk knives, we talk grinds, we talk technique, we talk all kinds of stuff. We talk business. So I'm Marco Malamasi, and with us is our friend Jeff Fader of Fader Knives.
Hello.
And Craig Lockwood of Chop Knives.
Bonjour, monsieur.
Sexy. Oh. Bring it on. What have you guys been up to this last week?
This has been a crazy week, my brother, and I'm tired. I'm actually quite sleepy. I just finished sending out all the Cuban knives. We sent out 35 of them and a couple pickups, and it was this. We shipped a day ahead, which I'm pumped about. We got everything finished, got everything sharp. I was sharpening knives, and I had my asshole was scrunched up the whole time. And other than that, it was fine. Was that too hard for right off the bat? I'm pretty sleepy.
The visuals, beautiful.
I went a little hard. I apologize, listeners. I apologize, but it was a sphincter closing day. We got it finished. We got everything wrapped up. Put them in the mail, and I'm just catching up on paper.
Yeah, it's
got
to feel good, though.
Yeah, they turned out awesome. And actually, Carl, he's such a good guy. Sabor Chef is such a good guy. I've been doing little videos and emails along the way to all the customers. And I've been sending him too. And he's just been pumped. And I said, listen, I got these watercolors. I mean, each knife had a watercolor. Did individual watercolors. He said, I'd like you to come up to pick to sign them. And he's like, I'm on my way. And he came right up. He came to the shop. We got the shop all squared away. I wanted him to see that it was a really big deal. And I wanted him to see that we weren't just like, you know, had sawdust everywhere, and it was a disaster. I had it real set up. He came in. I had food for him, and he was so pumped, and he signed, and he took me out for drinks, and he made me laugh harder than I've ever laughed before. My ribs hurt. That dude is so funny. I couldn't even – so it was a great experience. The whole project was great. I'm ready to go on to the next one, and it was a good week.
It looks so satisfying seeing those pictures you posted of all those knives lined up and when they're all ready to be shipped. It looked great.
I appreciate it, and I don't know who is more satisfied, me or my Carl Childs. He was the best part about it, honestly, was we were a team, and he was into it, and he was excited, and he was very meticulous about things, and if something was not right, even if it was the smallest thing, he got really into it, and he felt proud. You know, I took pictures with him, and he wanted to take pictures with me and Carl Ruiz, and he was into it, and it was a really, really, really satisfying experience for all of us. So
awesome. Great stuff.
Yeah, very happy.
What's the plan with Carl? Is Carl planning to make his own knives? Is
Carl Childs?
Yes, yeah, my Carl.
You know what? I'll tell you what. I don't know. I mean, I'd like him to make another knife if he wants to. He already made a knife, and actually, when his internship, and he told me this crazy story that his dad and his dad's friend were over at their house, and his dad's friend pulled the knife out and cut himself really bad on Carl's knife, and it was like blood everywhere. And at first, he was like, you know, I guess he went to the hospital and everything like that. And Carl was just like, I think he was just slightly satisfied that his knife, you know, these adults, they think that they know everything. But so I think that. I don't think so. Carl's actually, and I know he's very quiet about it, but he's actually thinking about, he wants to go to work on a farm in India.
Wow.
He's an intense kid. And my business partner and I offered him a raise to stay. So we'll see but he's a good kid. He's going to get ready for college, and he's just, you know, he wants to make the most of his youth, and I appreciate
it.
Yeah,
I love
good
it.
Stuff.
I bet his dad's friend did the classic, I'm going to touch the edge to see if it's sharp, and he fucking sliced himself right.
No, no, he actually had he was holding it in a way where his hand, the webbing of his hand, I think, was underneath the blade. So when he pulled it out of the Kydex sheath, it just ran it over his hand and apparently was like, it was like a gusher. They had to go to the hospital. And Carl was just like,
just sitting there smiling.
No, he was. I mean, everyone wasn't. I mean, not happy about it. Right. I mean, it was bad.
Yeah,
but it was like at the same time, it was just like, listen,
what do you expect?
Don't. Use your head. What have you been up to, Craig?
Well, I've been back in the workshop for a few days, and it's been great. So I've been, you know, working on customer orders, trying out a few new things, and just enjoying getting some work done, really, because I've had, you know, a month or two of just being in and out of the workshop. But these babies are staying put. They're not going anywhere. We've had a few scares, but all is good. But what I do want to say is a massive thank you to Jarrod for last week. From Boot Hill Blades, for stepping in last minute.
He did
a great job, and it was really good to listen to. And, you know, it made me want to be on the show. It was great to listen to as a listener.
For sure.
Yeah, and thank you to Mareko, who, like, it was we had some technical difficulties. We already had done a half an hour, and something happened with his feed, and he called me up, and he was just like, "You just do it yourself." And I just thank you for that, Mareko, and you know, it was sad you weren't in there, but
the show must go on, man. The show must go on.
Well, I appreciate it. And Jarrod went hard in the paint. Jarrod went hard in the paint with his beefs. He had some pretty epic beefs.
I heard them.
His beefs are tight, man.
Yeah.
So if you haven't listened to the last episode with Jarrod from Boot Hill Blades, might as well do it, because it was a good one.
It was a good time. It was very good. Mareko, what have you been up to?
I finally got that stainless steel Woods knife finished up. Got it all finished
up,
reformed that tip, got it all packaged, and it's out of my life. And it feels good. I actually followed that up with a bunch of Damascus forging. I've had these patterns that I've been sitting on and really been wanting to play with, but I had to focus on finishing that knife up. And so it's been really nice to transition out of a super stressful build right into something that I know really well, that's also somewhat experimental in a way. And I came up with a new pattern that's looking pretty sweet. And it feels good to get under the hammer, out of the forge, onto the grinder, and make some really sweet Damascus. And it's stuff I've never seen anybody else do before. A lot of the stuff I do isn't necessarily to do something that nobody's done before, but just to kind of push the boundaries and see what some of the patterns are capable of doing. And I think it's gonna be cool for everybody, because eventually I'll turn around and share it and the whole process so that other people can try to do their own.
It bends my mind when I see those pictures that you do, and you're like, "Well, we're going to chop it there, we're going to spin them, we're going to chop them there." I don't have that spatial awareness to sort of understand how it would look. But man, it's incredible. Incredible.
Me neither. I don't know. I still don't know how you guys do it. I have a hard time understanding how you get to where you need to get to with Damascus. That's another reason why I've given up on it.
Well, I'm happy to show you stuff, but I didn't realize how different it was that I can do that until a friend of mine, William Brigham, shout out to the Artificery on Instagram. He's an art major from UC Long Beach, and he was going over, like, he's super talented, very creative artist, great smith, and he too is just like, not very many people can do that, and that's... It almost sounds like I'm trying to be self-aggrandizing. It's weird because I don't even understand why I can do it. I just do it. I can explain how I can get to those patterns, but I can't necessarily explain why I can do it. I see it in my mind's eye and I draw it out, and then I reverse engineer it, and then I start from the beginning and make a pattern. It's super weird.
You have a system that works. You have a system that your mind goes, is able to make those leaps in it. That's how you have a map of how you're supposed to get there, and you have a very systematic way of thinking about it, and it makes it a lot easier for you to, you know, use that, you know, technique to figure out how you're going to do stuff. And it's great. Yeah. It's fantastic. I mean, you're one of the best in the world. That's for sure.
I don't know about that, but thank you. I'll take it.
Hey,
I'll take it.
I'm telling you. You're in my top five. You're in my top five of all time. You've always have been. You've been right. You're my Mount Rushmore.
Thanks, baby.
You've always have been.
Thank you.
Even before I met you.
You're very sweet.
Well, it's fine.
So this week I've been chatting with a few people and you know, other knife makers. And we got into the subject of something that I talked about just a couple of weeks ago, is how I got the name Chop Knives. And there's a little bit of a story to that, which was in a few episodes back. But it got me thinking about the importance of a good name. I mean, you know, there's myself, I use a brand name. Jeff uses his surname, and Mareko uses a bit of both with Mamasi Fire Arts. So I thought it would be something good to talk about. So,
hi, my name is
Craig Lockwood of Chop Knives.
What? My name is
Jeff Fader of Fader Knives.
My name is
Mareko Momasi of Momasi Fire Arts.
Gotta love a jingle.
You motherfucker, you. You motherfucker, you.
I love that. I love Marshall Mathers.
I'm
a fan.
You are a jingling fool. That's what you are. You're a jingling fool. You're making production back there.
Jingle all the way. Jingle all the way.
You're amazing.
But on a serious note, I have had quite a few questions. People asking me about, you know, what type of name they should go for. Then, you know, then talking about logos and how that's going to translate to a touch mark. So I was just wondering about you guys, you know, why you come up with the names that you've got, such as Fader Knives or Momasi Fire Arts.
You heard Jared's story last week.
Exactly.
Of how he got, that was unbelievable. That's another thing, you reason why you should listen to it, because he got sued because his name was the same as another knife maker, another knife company's name.
Yeah.
Crazy. He was so lucky. So lucky he had a good guy on his side.
Yeah, it's pretty incredible.
That was an unbelievable story.
Yeah. So let's start with you, Jeff. What, you know, did that go through your mind? Am I going to use my name? Am I going to use a brand name? You know, how did you come up with the Fader Knives?
I have the stupidest name for my touch mark and my name. Well, I'm not the stupidest name for my name, but you know, I didn't know what I was going to do, and I thought I was going to try to. When I started doing it, I was making sculpture, and I thought that I was going to incorporate some of the names of my sculpture. I think that names are very important. I met an old glassblower a long time ago the way he used to name his sculptures was the name is very important in when you're talking about art and sculpture. So I was very, very conscious of that. And I had all these names. And I was just like, yeah, you know what? I should just keep it simple because I also don't want to like, at the time I thought, I don't want to like, was this name taken? Is that name taken? So I thought I really felt like I needed to stick with Fader Knives. Mm. But my touch mark is the stupidest reason of all time. Long time ago, when I was a blacksmith, we used to go up to Bar Harbor, Maine, and there's an old barn. It's called the Tool Barn, and you can go there and you can spend hours in there. It's just filled with tools. So just, I mean, hours. At one point, they actually thought that I was shoplifting because I was in there for like 3 hours. So I was looking through. They had all these old stamps, and when I looked through the stamps, I found one stamp that had, it was three letters. It was G, H, and F. And I thought, eh, that's great. And my wife, or was my, at the time, yeah, it was my wife. She was my wife. And her name's Hillary. So I thought, G, H, Jeff, Hillary, Fader. And I thought, I'll just grab it, you know, a dollar or two. And then I started using it. And I was just like, why the fuck would I put my wife's name in my touch mark? And then, so I took a grinder. And I ground out the H. No disrespect to Hillary. No disrespect to Hillary. But it's like, I don't need this. So I took a grinder. I ground out the H. And then I had a G and an F with this giant space in between. And I'm like, well, that's dumb. What am I going to do now? So I started playing with like dots and this and that and the other thing. And I threw in this little like a starburst. Just like with a chisel. And then I hit it. And then hit it and made three little punches. And I was just like, yeah, I feel like it needs to be grounded some more. So I took a center punch and I put a dot on each side. And I was like, all right, I can live with that. So that became my center punch. That became my touch mark, a G and an H with a star in the middle and then two dots on the side. I just thought visually it looked good. And then I thought, yeah, G and H is fine. I don't want to have Fader Knives on my knives. I just figured I'd have the G and H and that's my touch mark. So that's how I got my touch mark. And it became a production, and I ended up just getting it stenciled, and I'm going to stick with it.
Yeah.
But it's like, you know,
well,
it's the dumbest reason of all time. But, I mean, it's just like, what am I going to do now? Well, what am I going to do now?
Stuck with it.
Here you
stuck
are.
With it. I think a lot of people don't realize that when you're thinking of a name, it needs to translate into a logo. As we said, it also needs to be a touch mark, and whether, you know, you need to consider whether that's going to be stamped or etched or lasered as well. If you're using, you know, a font, for example, you know, you need to make sure it's going to be legible. So I think that's maybe why we see so many different changes with people's brands. That always, I mean, I've refreshed mine probably 3 or 4 times in what, 3-4 years, because maybe you're not thinking of it sort of holistically from the very beginning.
Right.
Yeah, it's a tough one, you know, in regards to why use a name or a brand name. I think there's pluses and minuses to both. So, I mean, Jeff, you're using, you know, Fader Knives. It's, you know, it's you, you know, unless one day it's going to be Jeff and Carl printed on a knife, you know, it's Fader Knives. It's showing that it's made by you. That's a good thing to show that, it, you know, it's made by the maker.
I also like the fact that I wanted to look like it was, I mean, I, for years I was physically stamping in the touch mark. And I liked the way it looked, and I liked, you know, it brings me back to being a blacksmith, and I think it's great. So my stamp, my stencil stamp, I go deep with the etch, and I think that it looks kind of closer to that stamped look. And I think sometimes that's what etching is supposed to look like on touch marks, right?
Right.
Yeah. What about you, Mareko? Because, I mean, you've got a huge name, haven't you? Momassi Fire Arts.
Yes,
is, you know,
it's long.
It's long. In, you're long in length.
It does not translate into a good touch mark, I'll tell you, or at least a stamp, for yeah. sure. But I was anticipating using stencils, using an electro marking system. Malmasy Fire, obviously Malmasy is my last name, so the idea of Malmasy Fire Arts was this concept, which is still kind of in the books or on the plans, long term, of creating kind of a cooperative workspace, kind of along the lines of what. What's going on with Dragon's Breath Forge, but a place where people can teach and learn and also kind of have it like a makerspace, but very focused around metal arts, basically. And since I would be kind of the founder, it would be Malmasy Fire Arts. And so I was thinking about it that from that direction, as well as long term. It felt good because it felt like a good umbrella that a lot of maybe other offshoots could happen underneath. And so that's why I went with Malmasy Fire Arts instead of Malmasy Knives and Malmasy. And also, you know, a lot of, no offense to you, Jeff, there are a lot of makers who are just their first name and last and then knives. Or sorry, their last yeah. name and then knives. Uh-huh. And which works. I just, at the time, I really wanted to try to differentiate myself a little bit. And because, I mean, Malmasy is already weird and different enough, but I didn't want to just strap knives on the back of it, because people are going to be saying that anyways. They don't say Malmasy Fire Arts. They most everybody refers to my stuff as those Malmasy knives. So yeah, I was thinking kind of.
But you also have a touch mark too, though.
I do. I do. Yeah, it's the whole Malmasy Fire Arts. It says Malmasy Fire Arts all in one long line.
Don't you have a separate one on your butt plug?
So
on your butt plug.
That is actually part of my touch mark. It's two M's, stylized M's, rotating around each other, so they look kind of like flames. But that's for yeah. my initials, Mareko Malmasy, and it sits right in the middle after Malmasy and between Malmasy and Fire Arts. And so, yeah.
Nice.
And so,
Craig, did you refer to that? I'm sorry, but Craig. Did you call that his butt plug?
It is.
Is that what it is?
It's the plug on the butt of his knife. You know, on the back end.
Plug. It's threaded though. It's not a plug. It's threaded. So I call it.
Yeah. So it's not really.
It's a
butt
rivet.
Plug.
Some of those butt plugs are threaded, but that's another story.
What kind of podcast is this?
it's the female end of a Corby bolt, and so it
right.
It bolts on.
Have mercy.
So it's mechanically faceted, affixed to the tang of the knife.
Gotcha. And that's etched as well.
It is etched, which cool. took me a while to figure out how to get that right, but it works now.
Yeah, the same with me. I've had big issues with etching, so I've gone through various machines. I finally settled on something that really works for me, but yeah, I just couldn't get it right. And I was using I think you guys both use a personalizer, don't you?
Yes. I do.
Yeah. I got one. I was originally using one of those Etch-O-Matics, one of those little handheld things, and it was it was garbage. So I got a Personalizer Plus, but I just couldn't get a consistent result with it. And I think that's because they were originally designed for 110. But they do a 220 version, which I think has some sort of conversion. It's not designed from the ground up for 220.
Oh, interesting.
So I think that's the issue that I had, maybe. But yeah, I've got a Pico Electro, which is great. It works on 220, and it's given me this nice clean result finally.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's something that I've really struggled with, and you know, I didn't want to go down the lines of stamping because you know it's you know what it's like when you finish a knife. It's the last thing you're going to do, and it, you know if you crack something or break something at the end, it's not going to be good.
Yeah. It took me a while to figure out a good process, order operations. And my buddy Bill Grulick. Grulick Knives out of New Jersey. He's a really nice guy, super guy, and he gave me some really good tips. At the time, I was getting pretty good results, but they still could use some improvement. And he told me his process, which is he wipes with the neutralizer in between each pulse I guess like 5 to 7 second pulse of the etcher.
Right.
So he does a brr, like for a 5-7 count, something like that. And then he pulls it off, wipes the stencil, wipes underneath the stencil, wipes the steel. And then it's a big production, but the cleanliness of my marks was exponentially better. And so I'll take the extra, whatever, 5 minutes to do it, to make a superior, leave a superior mark on my blade, because ideally it stays there for the life of the knife. And if it's not deep enough, like Jeff was talking about how he likes to go pretty deep. I like to put my mark in pretty.
What are you laughing about?
Pretty good and deep. Just talking about deep marking.
Oh, okay. Okay. All right.
So yeah.
But how do you make sure that when you put it back on after you wipe it, that you're not doing like a hologram?
Yeah, that the stencil's lined up again. Yeah.
Yeah. So I have just a piece of electrical tape on only one side of the stencil, so it acts like a hinge. So it hinges off. I clean it all out and then put it back. It hinges right back to the exact same spot every time.
Ooh. Risky business. Risky business.
Risky. Yeah. Greg, you talked about your story a little bit. I mean, is there more to it? Do you think you want to maybe change it down the road? Do you think you want to add to it later? Or
I don't think so. I think it's happy. A case of trying to do something a little different, because, you know, without putting anybody off, there's plenty of bearded, tattooed knife makers out there with sort of similar logos. So I just wanted something that was completely clean. And, you know, there's not many brands, you know, in the kitchen. If you look around the house, you've got all these familiar brands everywhere. But if you're looking in your kitchen, and if you take away the sort of electrical stuff, you know, with regards to you know, whether it's knives, cutlery, whatever, there's no sort of brands that immediately jump out. So that was the idea behind Chop, because, you know, it's a short name. I was lucky enough to be able to get the domain. And that's something else that I think people need to think about as well when they're, you know, when they're thinking of a name. You need to make sure that the domain's available. And you do want to be bothering with, you know, .co or, you know, .us/.en, whatever it may be. You're going to want a .com at least. Yeah. You're going to want to make sure you've got, you know, the Instagram handle, possibly the Twitter and Facebook and that kind of thing. You know, it's times are changing. And I think more and more stuff is going to be done online. So again, with the logo, I wanted to make sure that it was clear and it could be printed at various sizes and still be legible.
Right.
So yeah, I think there's just plenty of things to think about when you're thinking of naming a company, not just a knife making company.
Sure. And that legibility is actually a really good point, because a lot of people actually really struggle to read my name in the first place, because Malmasy is very ethnic, I guess. Technically it is. It's Samoan. But when it's in the kind of stylized font and it's a little bit on the small side, so it fits on the knife underneath my applicator that I use for marking my stencil, it can be a little bit tight in there and difficult to read. So legibility, yeah, is definitely a good point. I like that you brought that up.
Marenko's notes to a new knife maker.
This week, I want to talk about packaging knives. It's something that I'm constantly, even after I've been doing this for 5 years on my own, I'm still talking to people about different ways that they package their knives and ship them out, especially when you start getting customers that are either across the country from you or even in another country from you. It's tricky trying to figure out how to safely package up the knife. And I've done all kinds of stuff. My packaging game was actually pretty weak in the beginning. But then I got to this point where I was building these wooden crates around the knives, which was really helpful. But it was also a little time-consuming. And most recently, I have started using a fiber board insulation or foam board insulation. At least in the United States, you can get it. And it's essentially a foam, a dense foam board that is used for insulating walls. And you can get them in 4x8 sheets. They break down into 16-inch wide sections. But you can also get smaller portions too if you don't need a whole lot. But with the flat rate boxes in the United States, they're 3 inches tall. So that's 3 1-inch sections of the foam board. So you can literally cut out a pocket and make a sandwich a foam board and very safely and package and ship your knife. It's super dense, so it doesn't compress very easily. Like, I could stand on top of one of these boxes after it's had the foam board, and I weigh 240 pounds. And it's not going to damage or mess with the knife at all. So essentially what I've been doing is I have two pieces that are cut out to the exact interior dimension. Actually, I have three pieces cut out of the exact interior dimension of these boxes. And then with the middle portion, kind of the meat of the sandwich, I lay the knife down after it's all wrapped up, however I'm going to wrap it up. And then I outline it with a pen. And then I go in, I have a kind of modified Sawzall blade that I'll post up a picture on Instagram. But it's a little modified Sawzall blade. And it just goes in, it's like carving a pumpkin. And so you just cut out the little cavity in that middle piece. And then you sandwich it all together, tape it up, send it off, and it's super secure. I just sent a knife to Australia. And it is the most comfortable I've felt about shipping a knife, I think ever, really. And especially after all of the trouble that I've gone through to make sure that knife is like spick and span and perfect before sending it out. Last thing I wanted to worry about is packaging. And those boards, they're also pretty cheap. You know, they're like $20, but you can cut them down depending on the size of the knife you're shipping and what size box you're shipping in them. You can get multiple knives shipped out using one of those 4x8 sheets. I just want to share some of my packaging game insight that I've recently come across. But again, it's the thing that I think a lot of people struggle with, and it's just, this is so easy that I had to share it.
Now, do you ship your knife with a sheath, or do you ship it in a container or some sort of packaging besides that, or you wrap them up or something?
So like that stainless knife, so I do wrap it up. I make sure it's all waxed out and oiled up the way I want, and then I wrap it in a little paper towel just to help have, I guess, something that's gentle against the blade. And then I wrap that in a plastic shrink wrap. And then that you can get like a little handheld about 6-inch wide thing of from Harbor Freight. And then that's when I cut out the cavity in that piece of foam board. And then I place it in there. And when I do have a sheath, like that stainless woods knife did have a sheath that went along with it. I do not ship in the sheath, because if for whatever reason there's some weird vibration or the box is dropped, you don't want any kind of unwanted inertia driving that knife down to the sheath in a way that it wouldn't normally be used and potentially damaging that thing or damaging the knife realistically. So I had them completely separate from each other and inside that.
In the same box.
In the same box, but cut out two cavities, one for each, and then shipped them in the same box, but not, I guess, coupled or put together. Separately from each other. So
that makes a lot of sense.
I learned that the hard way. I had a knife shipped to Hong Kong, and the customer got it, and I foolishly had sent it with the knife in the sheath. The knife was fine, but the sheath was not. And so unfortunately he had to send it all the way back, just the Saya. I had to do some work to fix that back. Actually, I had to make a brand new one. So actually he sent the whole thing back. And then I had to make a new one, but this time around I sent them completely separate, I sent it without the blade in the sheath. Sorry, I'm really struggling.
Got it. No, that makes a lot of sense. I would never have thought that. I can understand there being some rattling between the knife and the Saya. I would never have thought that you would need to do that. So that makes a lot of sense.
Right.
So. It's difficult. I mean, packaging is I've struggled a lot over the past couple of years, and I've tried all sorts, from vacuum forming my own sort of trays, and you know, actually as we speak, my wife is downstairs sewing up little Hessian sacks that I now put the knives in. You got to keep her busy while she's off work, you know.
you're unbelievable.
Slave driver.
This poor woman.
She's pregnant.
This poor woman. Unbelievable.
She's ready to pop. I've got some her nerve. Sewing.
Well, you have some nerve.
She enjoys it. We're a team.
Yeah,
nice making team.
She's a team. Yeah, team.
But yes.
You say she's a team.
So that's what I'm doing at the moment. So I'm getting just Hessian sacking, that material, and just making small pockets just to put the knife in
sure.
so they can be waxed and oiled, put into one of them. But at the moment then, I'm just putting into a box with these, you know, these peanuts, these plasticky foam peanut things.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, again, I need to up my game with that. And it's just always a struggle. So I went through a period probably about 6 months ago where I was each individual knife, I would vacuum form a tray to go inside a box.
Oh, wow.
Which looks great for presentation. It makes a great presentation box.
Yeah.
But when it comes to shipping, they're rattling all over the place. So that didn't really work out. But I'd like to go back to that and maybe, you know, work out how, maybe do a tray across the top as well. So it, you know, holds it firmly in place.
Sure.
I don't know. But the way you mentioned is, I mean, it's not a show without talking about Toma from Florentine, but he does something very similar with his shipping. So rather than use the foam, which you're using there, Mareko,
right.
he uses, it's like a corrugated card.
Okay.
And he just uses them in layers.
Yeah.
And he simply just cuts out the handle in one of them.
Right.
So then you just stack these corrugated card on top. It's fully sandwiched. He'll just wrap up the block of card that he has, and they're away. So I think that's a really nice way of doing it. So you're getting protection all the way around. It can't rattle.
Right.
It's something that I need to look into more, definitely.
Yeah, it's hard, man. I tell you what, when I first started in, I got those blade protectors and I got a tip guard and it just looked like it looked terrible. And I one of the reasons why I love doing my knives all go at Kydex sheaths are it helps with the shipping. It all protects the blade. It protects everything. It keeps it tight. There's good retention. So it's not rattling around in the case. And then what I do is, and I actually just posted it to, Jeff Fader, on Instagram, is I just posted all the packages I sent out with the Cuban knives. And what I do is I wrap them up like in butcher paper. I give a brown butcher paper. And the way I wrap it, it gives me a lot of protection on the tip and on the heel. But the tip I don't worry about because the Kydex is like, there's a good half an inch between the tip and the end.
Yeah.
And then I just try to make it nice and I write a little something on it and it fits in a priority box and I put a little ribbon on there. I make a little drawing on there. I make it kind of a little bit more personal. I mean, it's the easiest and most consistent and the safest way that I know how to do it.
Sure.
But in the meantime, my business partner, Tony, is like he's working with a box company because our oyster knives are the only thing that are kind of standard. Like all my knives are different every time. Mm-hmm. So if we were to get something made, the only thing that would work would be our oyster knives because they're, like I said, they're pretty standard. So we're looking to get one made and we're working on the boxing that fits into a small priority box and we're looking into it. You know, I'd love to have a better package when, like you said, like when you get an iPhone or any kind of Apple product, they figured it out. That makes you feel like you got something.
Yeah.
And I think that to try to figure out a way to make that work plus with the safety of shipping is definitely something to address.
Well, it's tricky because companies like that, they can afford the capital up front to buy literally thousands of those boxes all at once. And I would love to get some of them, just the presentation boxes that a lot of commercially manufactured knives are sold in or shipped in. They show up, they have these like nice little magnetic flaps. It opens up like a briefcase kind of in a way. It's got an infographic on the inside. It's got this form fit, like the foam and stuff on the inside.
Yeah.
And everything just fits really nice. I'm like, man. But the struggle is that because, at least for me, you know, I'm making in such small quantities that I can't just, it doesn't make sense to buy literally like 500 of these boxes and then not use any of them. Like all but maybe
that's hard
yeah.
maybe a few
and most will have
that's hard.
Most will have like a minimum order quantity as well, so
exactly.
Before I got my vacuum forming machine, I was looking to get these trays formed sort of in a factory, but they're looking
right.
at sort of 3,000 to 4,000 as a minimum order.
Oy.
Because obviously
yeah.
they need to set up their machine and do all the rest
right.
of it, so you know it can be done at home, but again it's not the best protection for shipping. And when you're looking
sure.
for that, you know, that magic sort of balance between looking really cool and, you know, looking really plush and luxurious, you also need it to be, you know, hardcore or protective for the knife, which that's the struggle.
You know what would be, you know what would be cool, and anybody wants to use this idea, go ahead, is you do a big Kydex sheet. You get your Kydex sheet, because, you know, you buy Kydex, and it's not that cheap. I mean, not that expensive. And you do a big, like the size of a priority box, and you Kydex up two pieces with your knife inside. So when you open it up, you get this sheet with this crazy knife inside. And you could do that. Feel free. Go ahead.
Yeah.
I don't know.
And I was doing that with the vacuum forming, which is, I think it's basically what you're saying to do with the Kydex, really. So it takes the form, takes the shape of the knife.
Right.
You can go down a rabbit hole. So there's this whole sort of thing called flocking then, which, you know, that lovely sort of cloth lining. So you just take your normal plastic, which you formed, and then you flock it. Which is lots of little bits of cloth that goes on.
Flock it. And just flock it.
There's a whole community of flockers. They love flocking.
Yeah, mother flockers. The whole thing. You'll flock them. Flock you. Let's go, baby. Flock it. All right.
Hey, man. Can I ask you a question?
Well. Here we are again. Hey, man, can I ask you a question? Oh, with that said, let's just start in with, we've just made it a decision, a conscious decision, and I think this is going to be a lot of fun. Hey, man, can I ask you a question to turn into something? I know that earlier last week I was on, I was watching Will Stelter, our good buddy Will Stelter. He does a lot of live feeds. Unfortunately, he seems to think live feeding while you're painting is a good idea, but you got to figure that out.
Literally,
so he was
painter.
Alive. Yeah, it was literally, it was crazy. I was just like, dude, is this what's going to happen when Alex shows up to Montana? You're just going to like paint, live feed while you're painting? So he was doing the live feed, and I came in, and he goes, oh, Fader's here. And I wrote, hey, man, can I ask you a question? And then his mother was on, and I said, his mother's on. Hey, Will's mom, can I ask you a question? And then all of a sudden it turned into this funny thing, and I thought, you know what would be funny would be is if we start to do as Knife Talk podcast, if we started to go on to people's live streams and ask them a question, or we use the lives, Instagram Live more often to have interactive opportunity with our listeners to do like a mobile version or a guerrilla version of, hey, man, can I ask you a question? So
it almost sounds like trolling.
Well, I mean, you know, we're in this together. I think that, you know, we're going to try to not be assholes. And, the nicest way. So either Mareko or Craig or I will at some point, you know, zip around. If we're on the Knife Talk and we see you doing a live, we're encouraging you to do a live. Maybe we'll hop in and we'll ask you a question, or you can ask us a question. We'll try to be more interactive. So that's that. All right. The first, hey, man, can I ask you a question? Comes from Hyde Handmade, and he asks, what nugget of knowledge do you wish you knew as a novice knife maker? Love that question.
I'm still a novice. Still a novice.
Well, I mean, what do you know? What would you know? What would you wish you told younger Craig that you know now?
I think maybe take your time. Get everything perfect before moving on to the next knife, because definitely sort of guilty of that, you know. My goal is always to make the best knife that I can, not the fastest. So, yeah, take your time, make sure everything's perfect. So, but if you do make a mistake, finish it. Because, you know, that finishing will allow you to practice other stages. It may not be a knife that that you're going to sell or give away to somebody, but you can still put that practice in by finishing that knife. So, yeah, take your time and finish what you start. Yeah, finish what you start. I've actually got a big poster up in my shop saying finish what you start, because I'm terrible at it. So that would be what I'd tell little Craig.
Little Craig. What about little Momasi Fire Arts? What would you tell young Mareko?
I wish that I had better understood that it's okay for things to build slowly. I think what I know now is that for the best legacy and longevity is for things to build slow. And I think too often, especially if you're trying to do this full time, it's easy to get caught up in the rat race of getting the most followers or getting, I don't know, just like all of that kind of stuff, the most recognition. It's like, you know what? It's okay. Just take your time. Let it build up organically, because what the best thing is about going the slow way is building up a community around you as well. So you have people that are with you from the very beginning that say, I've known him since he first started, or I've been following him since he first started. And they're proud to feel like they've been part of that journey. They get to actually watch that journey. And I think I got caught up myself a little bit, especially, and I think it was a lot of the pressure from being full-time was trying to get as much kind of like recognition or get as many followers as possible, just because that seemed to be the metric that translated into a viable business, basically. But that doesn't actually necessarily translate into a viable business or sustainable business. And so I think I wish I had somebody who was there who said, it's okay, it's going to take a little time, but as long as you care about it. And that's the biggest filter, is like, if you're okay with it taking time, that's a big identifier, I think, for a lot of people, of whether or not they're doing the work that they're meant to do or that they're good at, is that they're willing for it to take time and to go slow. But yeah, I wish I had somebody to say, it's all right, just do the work, you're going to get there, especially if you're doing work, good work, you build up that community around you, you're going to be fucking unstoppable.
Yeah.
But it's going to take time.
Well, I think that that's very, I mean, I was going to say along the same things. And I know that when people, especially if you're going to take a class, if you're going to go take a knife making class, and this is the first time you made a knife, a lot of times people are going to have this expectation. You're going to have this feeling of, this one's got to be good. This is the first time I'm doing this. I need to make sure that this one's good. And a lot of times people don't understand and allow themselves to realize that the first 20 are not, the first 20 aren't going to be great. And understand that you're not going to walk in and be a black belt right off the bat. And that's the hardest part. Even when I took a Nick Anger class, I've been a knife maker for a while. I was like, this one's got to be good. And you don't, you know, you got to make sure this is good. And it was hard to just allow the learning to happen. And I totally agree with the both of you. It's just this idea of not putting too much pressure on yourself that they got to be good off the bat, or not have a little bit of awareness that the first couple are going to suck. So you just got to let them suck. And every time you do it again, they suck less. So suck less. All right. Here's the next question.
Hey man, can I ask you a question?
that one is my favorite one, by the way. That one, I think that even beats Carl's. So this is from Knife Talk alumni Fingal Ferguson, who asks, I'm on the verge of buying a variable speed disc grinder. Are they worth it? What are the benefits?
I think, Jeff, you should start that one off.
Definitely. I'm with Fingal.
I will tell you this.
I'm with Fingal because I'm on the verge myself. So, Jeff, you need to sell it to me.
I'm going to sell it to you without a sponsor and without a company behind me, because listen, guys, here's how it is. If you want me to say your name, you gotta, you know, I'm putting my fingers together here. So so I'm not going to tell you who to get, but we're talking, you know, fingers. So I tell you what, when Carl was my intern, I had to teach hand sanding. I had to teach my system of hand sanding. And when we were doing stainless steel, it's a lot harder off the belts, no matter what your progression is, it's a lot harder because it was just harder. It was harder to hand sand. So with hand sanding, you're doing the peaks and the valleys, and you got to take off the peaks and you got to get to the valleys, right? So what a disc grinder will do, there's a couple different things. One is you're going to take the high spots off to make it easier to get to your final dimension, and it's going to show you the high spots a lot easier, the low spots. It's going to show you where your low spots are. It's going to show your high spots, and it is going to, hand sand your work, it's going to make it easier to get to that stage. It will cut down your hand sanding by half easy. The second thing is, if you're doing like handles, I use, for when I did all the Cuban knives, I broke all the corners and I rounded the profiles of the knives with the disc grinder, and they're really awesome for handles. Wah style handles, they're great for, it's quiet too. That's unbelievable. But in regards to cutting your time down and your efficiency down, you are hand sanding a lot less, and you're able to kind of fine tune your geometry. Like my geometry has gotten so much better because I'm able to kind of like change the paper out. I can change the speed. I'm not putting as much friction on the knife. So I'm not overheating the knife. I'm getting even. I can hold the whole thing on the against the disc. I cannot stress enough how great a disc grinder is. I love them. A variable speed's awesome. And the great thing with the variable speed, if you switch the speeds from forward to reverse, you're getting a different, you can load the paper up the other way. So you're getting a little bit more wear out of your paper.
The paper, how is the paper attached? Is it like a Velcro back in, or are you using a adhesive?
No, I buy sheets of RhinoWet. Oh, I didn't say that. I buy sheets of sandpaper, and then you get this stuff called feathering, disc feathering paste. It's like it comes in like a toothpaste tube, and it's like an adhesive paste, and you kind of like spin it. I will give a shout. If you want to watch, I will say this. If you want to see how you're supposed to use a disc sander, and I made my decision after I watched this video, go see Nick Wheeler does a video on disc sanding. I watched his 10-minute disc sanding video, and I pulled the trigger on buying one after I watched his. So Nick Wheeler, as you know, Nick Wheeler does awesome videos, one of the best knife makers in the world, as far as I'm concerned. But he does incredibly good videos, and his videos on disc sanding, you'll see how he does it, and then he does you'll make your decision there. That's my opinion.
So it's completely changed your belt progression then?
Yeah. Okay. For sure. That's good. I'm not going straight from the belts to hand sanding. I'm actually using less belts, and I'm finishing everything off on the disc sander. I love the disc sander. I think it's great. I mean, it's not going to help you with, if you're doing full flat grinds, it's going to be great. If you're doing anything, hollow grinds, you're out, and it's not going to help you too much with, if you're doing S grinds, not going to help you in that middle part, but it does.
Definitely not.
Yeah, for sure. But it definitely is one of those things that will refine your blade profile. You'll see any problems that you had all through the disc grinder. Cool. Off the belt sander.
You know, this is something we should definitely speak about next week, sort of our belt progression and how we go from our standard stock to a finished blade. Because that's probably the question that I'm asked the most, actually. You know, what belts are you using? What grits are you using? So, we could talk about that for probably some time. So maybe we can do that next week.
And it also gets a little bit dicey because people are like, well, why are you going to that? Why do you jump into that? Well, it's like, it's also one of those things is like, why do you brush your teeth that way? There's certain things that, they're going to be a little bit, the way I do things are going to be different the way you do things.
Yeah, exactly. So exactly.
Hey, man, can I ask you a question?
All right. Here's in honor of Carl, here's the question I like the most. This comes from Jesse Savage Blacksmith. Why does Jeff hate hand picks? I'm gonna let you guys answer, and then I'm gonna tell you the correct answer.
Because I've seen Jeff's hands, so obviously you're not gonna want them in a picture.
All right. Okay. That's answer number one.
I think. Well, Jeff has made it clear that he thinks it's about people comparing the size of their schwanz to their hands, and so. I don't understand. Why do you go there, Jeff?
All right.
Why do you think about that?
I'll give you the funny answer, and I'll give you the real answer. The funny answer is I like a little controversy that I can talk my way out of. I think it's funny. I think that it's fine. I'll be honest with you. I don't give a shit what you do. Go ahead. Do whatever you want. If you want to, do whatever you want. This is the real, and I think it's funny that people get mad about it, that I say something, and I like that. I like a little bit of controversy. I'm not here for being funny. I want to tell jokes. So that's number one. Number two is the real answer is I feel like in this business, you've got to figure out a way to separate yourself out from everybody else. And the hand picks became something that I just started to notice as something that, this guy's doing it, so I'm going to do it. And I was actually, when I was talking to Jared last week, he was asking me if I thought there was going to be a bubble. Is there going to be a bubble with so many new makers coming up? And what I said to him was, well, if people can figure out a way to separate themselves or differentiate themselves from other people and not focus on pictures for other knife makers to like, but pictures that customers are going to like, then they're not going to have to worry if there's a bubble, because then you're not really necessarily buying a knife. You're buying something that was made by somebody that you recognize. I want Mareko's knife. I want Jeff's knife. I want Craig's knife. So if you're going to do those stupid pictures, go ahead. I'm just going to take your customers, because what you're doing is you're
you're not allowing yourself to be as individual as you want. And what you're going to do is you're giving a picture that customers are not going to care. They're not going to, your buying decision, and I disagree with what Alex said a while ago about, you know, he said that it's okay, he likes it. I disagreed with him because I felt like you're not, if you're trying to be in business, you've got to figure out your demographic, not, you know, other knife makers that you know, it's nice to be appreciated by other knife makers in your community, but they're not the ones buying your knives. So I just think right. that you've got to figure out a way to branch yourself out, to make your, it's about, and this is the reason why it's Fader Knives and not something else, is I'm trying to connect it with me because I'm trying to create something a little bit more than just getting a black knife from a store. You know, I'm trying to create something a little bit more, you're getting something from a person. And part of that is being original and figuring out different ways to do things. I posted that picture last week of me in like some pathetic, you know, lotus position. And it was a funny picture, but I was like, after Carl took the picture and I looked at it, I was just like, yeah, nobody does that. So I'm trying to figure ways in which to be a little bit different to set myself apart. And I think that the hand picks, just that to me says, all right, well, I'm not thinking too hard about this. I'm making the knife in my shitty hands and that's going to be enough. And then it's not going to be enough. So that's the my reason. So Jesse, there you go. And I must say, I apologize for the last episode. I called our listeners gutless. And now that I think about it, I still think you're gutless. This is why you're gutless now. You're gutless now because it was like chirping cricket. You know, 2 weeks ago, you were at mentioning me, and now it's crickets. So you're gutless for listening to me. You're gutless for listening to me. And I love you, but you're gutless. That's the answer for that. You ready for another question?
Hey, man, can I ask you a question?
All right, this one is made for Garmin. This is by Garmin Made. I'm looking to buy a Radius Platin, and I was wondering what works best for a chef knife.
All mine are flat.
Radius Platin.
All mine are flat.
Well, what do you use, Mareko? Like, what would like, even if you were going to make one?
Yeah, so I made mine. It's just a piece of 2-inch by 1/2-inch mild steel that was bent and then welded onto a piece of angle iron. But I shot for replicating a 6-foot diameter wheel, so a 3-foot radius, depending on how people put them up. But actually, I don't know if anybody's really selling them except for our boy Bill Bennett Banky.
The greatest. Banky? Yeah.
I always screw
that. I don't know if I'd call him our boy. I mean, he's older than all of us. He's the best.
He's our homie.
He's our homie. No, he's our homie. He's the greatest.
He's been on the show. He's been on the show in the past.
He's fantastic.
He has.
He's fantastic. Yeah. He's my favorite.
He makes all kinds of tools. And he's working on developing a line of Radius Platins that are pretty versatile across different machines. And I got a hold one. I don't even know if I'm supposed to be talking about this, but I think it'll help boost them up. But I got a hold of one to test, and it's good. It's good. And so I think it's going to, if people want to get in there and do a Radius Platin, it's, you know, if you got the skills and the tools to make your own, sure, make your own. But save yourself some time, maybe. It's probably worth it to just buy one from somebody who's doing one or right. who's having them made. And I like the 6-foot radius, or sorry, 6-foot diameter, 3-foot radius, essentially replicating a large wheel, which especially in Japan they use super large wheels, anywhere from 3 foot to I think like 8 or 9 feet sometimes, for grinding their knives. And when they do like a single bevel yanagiba, like a sashimi knife or a sushi knife, they have a hollow on the backside, and it is from that large wheel. And it's, of course, it depends on who the grinder is, but it's usually between 4 and 6 feet. And there, so I like the 6-foot because it's subtle. It does the job of creating the S grind, but it's not so dramatic that it kind of cuts the life short of the knife. Cause you'll see some, folks who are doing super deep, S grinds that go like straight down to the middle of the knife. Almost. And, you know, once you get up or get to the bottom of that trough, like, it's done. Versus the way I grind mine, it's sustainable literally throughout the entire life of the knife. In fact, you might have to go back in and recut it or have it recut because versus that hollow doing a disservice to the knife. So, I like it because it's shallow, it does the job, and it's sustainable over the life of the knife. 6 foot diameter.
So these are alternatives to wheels. So I assume if you've got a grinder which isn't variable speed, you couldn't use, obviously you couldn't on a standard grinder anyway, a 6 foot wheel, because the speed of the outer edge of that wheel would be huge.
So you just need to bump out your platen.
Terrifying.
You need to bump out your platen.
Yeah, got you. Okay, nice, yeah. Nice.
I would imagine you could probably just take a 2x4 and kind of like shape it and try to just to get an idea and, figure out a way to tape it to your platen. I'm sure that you could figure something out, but, in the meantime, but you got to make it happen. All right.
Yeah. Long term, metal's going to be best.
Hey, man, can I ask you a question?
This comes from NMB Steel and Leather. What does everyone's personal knife look like?
Ooh, personal knife at home.
Yes.
Man.
Or wherever. Personal life in your car. It doesn't matter to me.
Just driving around with knives in your car.
I've got this hodgepodge of unperfect knives of my own, which never got to a customer. They're like, hey, to the wife, I've got you a present. So they're up on the knife rack. But I'm using a lot of, I always talk about Florentine knives, but I'm using a Florentine chef knife, which I've had for probably a couple of years now. And it stood up to the test of time. It's a great knife. So I'm either using one of my own or I'm using a Florentine knife, basically.
What about you, Mareko?
Love it. We have one of my own knives here. I gave it to my wife as a wedding gift. And so I figured that was the only way that I could convince her to let us have one of our knives, if it was a gift to her. otherwise, it was at a time when, I was a fledgling, like I was just starting the business. And so it was going to be a pretty big financial hit to just absorb that cost. Mm. But we have the one chef's knife. We have some like janky little shitty paring knives that we keep around the house just for like little stuff, quick stuff. And then we also have a sweet bread knife that I made that started out as a chef's knife, and I could not get the finish to come out properly on it. And it was going to go to a customer, and I was like, nope, can't do that. And I had started all over, so I set that knife aside, and I turned that. And then I was like, you know what? It would be cool to practice cutting serrations and make this into a bread knife, because my wife had just started bread baking. And she was making this incredible bread. And so why not have a really sweet knife to cut that bread with? And so those are the two fancy knives.
And that was the knife I brought with me on. That was the knife I had on the Epicurious video.
Yeah.
Well.
What do you got, Jeff?
I have my Wusthof from culinary school that I've still been using. I've only recently had a knife of my own, and it was a knife I forged at Jesse Savage's a few years ago on his 25-pound Little Giant, and it wasn't really something that I wanted to sell. It didn't really look like it. It didn't come out the way I wanted it to come out, and I decided to – I wanted to take a look at, how unstabilized – walnut holds up and carbon steel and little brass. So I have my own little beater. It's nothing special. It's not something I could really get rid of. I mean, I could get rid of it. Trust me. I could heave it into the woods if I wanted to, but it's not something I could sell. And it's just I just wanted to see how my knives hold up in terms of, the handles, and it's different than everything else I've ever done. And it's been a lot of fun kind of fooling around with it and, Yeah,
I think it's important to use your own stuff because you need to make sure that it's working, that it's gonna it's gonna hold up to time. So yeah. I made a, like Mareko was saying, a bread knife. So I made a bread knife probably about 6 months ago, and actually with a lot of help from Mareko, he actually called in and gave me a bit of help. But I've been using that, and I wanted to see how that's gonna hold up, and it's held up well. So I think I'm gonna start making sort of a. Not a production line of them, but to start offering them to customers. But it's not something that I'd do if I hadn't tested it for some time myself. Because who knows? You don't want, 2 months down the line, a bunch of knives coming back to you because, the wood that you used is swelling or, for whatever reason.
I'm glad it could be helpful.
Hey, man, can I ask you a question?
All right, this comes from Hall Blades. Chef knife heels. Heel to spine is 2.5 to 3 inches. Is that too tall? If so, why? And please know, do what you want answers. You know, he's like, he wants a real answer. He doesn't want me to say, make whatever the hell you want. So he wants to know if what's the size of the heels of your knives and what's correct and what's not correct. If there is something like that, I don't even think there is something correct.
Yeah, I mean, my standard chef knife is 50 mil, which is, I suppose that's 2 inches. And that just seems to work well for me. It gives you a nice weight. I'm generally using sort of either a 2.3 or a 3 mil stock. So if you're using a 2-inch or 50 mil heel, it tends to give quite a nice weight. And I don't think you need any bigger, really. I mean, I don't think there's any right or wrong, but my personal preference would be around about the 2 inches.
I think 2.5 to 3 inches. I don't know if that's necessarily a chef's knife anymore. That's starting to get into like Chinese cleaver kind of range. I think the issue, I mean, obviously, sorry, he doesn't want to hear it, but you can do what you want. But I think moreover, you're going to have a hard time finding people who are really excited to buy knives that are outside of what is considered kind of the norm when it comes to at least dimensions, and that part of that dimension is the heel height. 2 inches, I think, is a pretty solid standard. I take mine to about 2 1/8 or 2 1/4 at the very most, but outside of that, it starts to get kind of awkward more than anything just to use. But the when you get up to 2.5 to 3 inches, you're starting to get into a little bit of a specialized area, and I think people's argument would be, well, that means it's got that much more life on the knife, but if it's awkward to use, like, what's the benefit? And so, but ultimately, like, if your customer wants a 2.5-inch to 3-inch knife, like, yeah, build them a 2.5-3-inch knife. But, you know, I think if you're doing it on your own and then you think you're going to turn around and flip that knife pretty easily, you're getting into a specialized range where you're, I guess, the number of people who are going to be interested in that size of a knife is getting smaller and smaller, and it's going to be harder and harder to find those people. Same thing goes for like super long chef's knives. Some people want to make 12-inch long chef's knives. Like, I don't know very many people out there who really like to use 12-inch long chef's knives.
No.
You're starting to get into a short sword situation.
For sure. Absolutely.
Yeah, that's my opinion.
I think that, you know, when I first started basing my knives, I did 2 inches because that's what, you know, my Wusthof is 1 7/8. And I like that. And a lot of it has to do with how you're, like you were saying, how you're holding it. If you're making a 10-inch chef's knife with a 2.5-inch heel, all of a sudden your radius is different and the handle's going to be higher up than if it were at 2 inches. You're actually going to be at a different standing position. So I don't necessarily think, and I made some 2.5-inch heels. I made a 2 1/4-inch heel. It's a lot of knife. All of a sudden, you don't think so, but it's a lot more knife. And I just think that I think 2 1/4 is the farthest I'd go, unless, like you said, somebody wants something specialized, then that's it. And I is there a right or wrong? You know, there's that stupid video of that weird guy in Russia chopping shit in the woods and making the chopping noises. You know, he's making like burgers in the fire, and he's got that, you know, he's got like basically a plowshare for a knife. You know what I'm talking about?
What video is this?
This guy. He's in like, I don't know if he's in Russia or he's somewhere in the woods, and it's always snowing. And they'll do a close up of some wooden board that he found in the woods, and then he'll make into the, you know, it's on a lot on Facebook, and then he'll like chop up with. He's got this. It looks like a sharpened shovel. This knife is so goddamn big, and he's chopping up, mincing, and then he's making everything over the fire. It's this whole big production. This guy is like this Russian mental patient, but he's got like a million views because he's making these, like, you know, it's like, you know, hashtag food porn. It's gooey, and there's always some bullshit going on, and he's got that big ass snow shovel knife. I thought you guys knew about it. Well, that's it.
No,
do you want to do one more question, or you want to head out?
Let's do another.
Head out into beefs. All right.
Hey, man, can I ask you a question?
Okay. Now we're going to have a question from Josh Scott Knives. What in your background do you attribute most of your success as a knife maker?
Josh Scott, deep questions, bringing it home from Ohio.
Marenko. Go ahead. Do you want somebody to take that first?
What sure, from I'll your start. Background? What from your background do you attribute what the most your of background? Your success as a knife maker? Go ahead.
Well, I kind of touched on this on one of my first Notes to a Young Knife Maker, but I think what it attribute has really helped lend success for me, it has been the fact that I make knives that I know how to use. I make culinary knives, I make chef's knives, kitchen knives, because I know how to use those knives. And I think the people who make the knives they know how to use are going to be the most successful, because you understand how balance should, whether the balance is blade heavy, handle heavy, right in the middle. You've worked with a bunch of different knives that have those kind of qualities. You understand how it's supposed to feel, whether you're doing some rock chopping and mincing, or if you're, doing some draw cut or push cutting. I think what has really helped me be successful is knowing the knife before even trying to make something. Like if I made a hunting knife, like it'd probably be a good hunting knife, but I've never broken down an animal. I could never say this is a really, really great hunting knife. It might be the best hunting knife you'll ever use. That would be a total lie. But with my chef's knives, I feel a bit more comfortable saying, this could be one of the best knives you ever use. I'll never say that it is because, people have different opinions. But yeah, I think knowing the tool has made me successful in making culinary knives, chef's knives.
Yeah. What about you, Craigie Poo?
I've never worked in a professional kitchen, but I love cooking. I cook every day. It's something I look forward to. So in a similar vein to Marenko, I think it's spending time in the kitchen, understanding what works, what doesn't work. But on a sort of professional level, I was a designer for, 18 years before making my first knife. So I think that plays quite a big part in the knives that I make. They all start on a screen, which I then print off a mock-up before making a profile, so I can see how it feels in the hand. Then I can go back to the screen if need be to make any corrections. And with regards to sort of the whole marketing side of things as well, I think having a design background maybe helps there as well. But I think there's many skills that you could bring to the table. No matter what you are. I say most people will cook, so most people have a knowledge of what works as a knife, and whatever whichever corner of the earth you come from, you can have something that you can bring to the table to make your knife different to anybody else's.
Well, I definitely think that being a sculptor for so long, it's been a huge help, and because a lot of it's because what you have an idea of what you're going to make, and then you design it, and then you execute it, and you see it all the way through. What that is, it's so freeing for me because it helps me to just say, it's not just like, well, I wish I could make something. I know what I'm going to do, and I make it happen. So it's one of those things that you become a little bit, once you can execute, especially giant sculpture, you become a little bit more fearless about other things. That was a huge thing for me in terms of just saying I'm going to do this, and it was very, I was very lucky that I was able to have that mindset, because I think it's the mindset of what your background is like, you don't think too strongly about it and you just make it happen. The other thing is I worked in a lot of metal shops. One, besides being a blacksmith at the Center for Metal Arts, I was a finish sander at a place where we did ornamental ironwork for buildings. We did a ton of cladding. We did so much hand sanding. We were hand sanding. We were doing directional stainless steel. I was learning about finishing, and we were using tons of sandpaper, stroke sanders and belt sanders and DA sanders. And you get this understanding of this work, this tedious work, and how you can just kind of vision your way through it. So my experience in the shops that I was in, plus being a sculptor, was tremendous, tremendous. Because I'm not 100% sure I would have had the confidence to make these things done. Like this last project of 37 knives, I don't think I would have had the confidence to be able to do it all if I hadn't been in shops where it was, we had deadlines. We had to pull out a lot of materials, and we had to build elevators and build railings and build. If you don't have that vision, it becomes daunting, and you just can't get past it. So my experience as a metal worker was huge too. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there you go. So, hey man, thanks for the questions.
You know
Let's
what?
Let's keep doing it.
We've had a few people asking. I mean, since we had Jared on the show last week, we've had a few people saying, "Man, can I be on the show?" And I mean, it's not an open door. We're the hosts, and Jared come in and did us a huge favor, and he did a great job. But if you do want to be on the show, I mean, you could. You could always send a video. "Hey, man, can I ask you a question?" We can rip off that audio and put it into the show. So if you've got a question for us,
send us
a video. I mean, put it on your feed. Start it with, "Hey, man, can I ask you a question?" And we could take that audio and you can be in the show.
And wear your clothes.
Oh, definitely wear clothes. Definitely.
Wear your clothes. Just trust me. I actually...
Go on, sorry.
So one thing I will say is somebody wrote, you know, we started following everybody because we want to have this interaction with people. And somebody wrote, "I'm only 14 years old and I make not..." And then there was this blurred picture. And all I could think of is, "Oh my God, please, please have your clothes on. Please have your clothes on. I don't want to know. I don't want to know." That's why I'm saying it. I was nervous. It was just, you know, I'm 14 years old and there's this blurred picture coming up. I'm like, what the hell kind of podcast is this? So now we're at beef time. Let's go into the beefs.
Who the hell are you following? Jeez.
Craig's Community Showcase.
So, talking of young boys... That's a terrible intro.
It's terrible.
But we've got a 16-year-old bladesmith from Wyoming, which I found on Instagram this week. Jack Henry Knives, which is Jack_Henry_Knives. This guy's 16 and he's making some amazing stuff. He's making his own Damascus and he's got this beautiful feather Damascus. It's beautiful. And he's got this beautiful Kruvi Damascus knife with, well, it's a samurai as well. So it's, you know, it's a folded, it's beautiful. So take a look at its profile. It's Jack_Henry_Knives. Really great handle work too. And this kid's just 16. Cool. So go check out his work.
Check it out.
Also got a website at jackhenry.com.
I love these young... I tell you what, after Liam Hoffman made it happen, all these young guys are coming through with the heavy heat, and I love it.
Well, it's beef time.
I think I got to go last. Sorry.
You got to go last.
I'm going to get too crazy. Okay. I get so fired up that I get a little bit... I get close to passing out. I got my head... The blood rushes to my head, and I can't handle it anymore. So I think I...
Okay.
Yeah.
Miracle.
Well, I'll go
what's
first.
Your beef?
Yeah. Okay. This week, I kind of touched on it actually a little bit at the beginning. But so if you ever go to a knife show, and especially as a exhibitor there, one of the things that drives me... absolutely bonkers and pisses me off and it actually offends me a little bit is when people pick up their knife. They're very polite, they ask to pick up your knife and take a look at it, and then the next thing they do is put their fingers along the cutting edge to check the sharpness. And I'm just thinking, are you fucking stupid? Like,
the
you're gonna cut
worst.
Your finger open.
The worst.
And first off, if the knife is taken up to a really high finish, it actually doesn't feel that sharp. You don't feel that toothiness. Mm. And it's because it's been taken to such a fine finish, those micro serrations along the cutting edge are microscopic. So you're not really going to feel them. And so people feel along the cutting edge and they're rubbing their fingers and stuff. I'm like, you're an idiot. You're going to, like, get out of here.
Do you know what
you're
that means,
cut
though?
Your hand. You're going to get blood all over my knife and I'm going to get fucking pissed.
You know what that
I'm
means, though?
Pissed,
when they're
but...
when they're sticking their... No, when they're, my mother did that to me once and I almost threw her out of the shop. It's not... They put their thumb on. In their mind, they're saying, I'll see how sharp this is. I'll be the inspector. I'll see how sharp it is. And then they put their glasses down on the end of their nose, and I'll be the judge of this. It's very – it's a narcissism, and it's obnoxious. I'm with you 100%.
Yeah.
I'm going to ask you a question right now. Hey, man, can I ask you a question? What do I do when I go to knife shows?
You don't touch anything.
I don't touch shit. If you these people say, "Hey, pick it up," I won't touch a fucking thing. I won't touch a goddamn thing because I know how much work you guys do in it. I say that. I always say that when you see me at a knife show, I'll always say, "I don't touch. I don't touch. Don't touch."
You know, talking about knife shows, we may have some news very soon about something happened at a knife show, and I'm going to leave it at that.
That's a good radio tease right there, Craigie boy.
I've got a beef, a serious beef. People on Instagram, and it's normally companies They may have a product or a service for other knife makers, and they're using half-naked women to promote their product. What the hell? I mean, some don't even show the product.
What are you looking for, half-naked men?
nice. But I mean, some aren't showing the product as if we're all, you know, knuckle draggers who can't help themselves if we see a, you know, a cheeky nipple or an arse cheek. You know, this isn't the 1970s. The days of harmless Benny Hill style titillation is over. It's done.
Oh,
so be more creative. Don't be lazy and show us your product in the best light.
Baby, show us your product.
I'm not going to name any names, but one of these companies, they produce, well, they're factory knives, but they're sold in most cookware stores. And I can't believe they think this is doing them any favours, you know? So put the work in,
really?
Come up with a different angle, because it's just insulting. It's insulting.
Yeah, put your clothes on.
Beef over.
Come on. No one wants to see your nanny beautiful naked people. Come on. We all want to see your awful knives.
What goes back to you?
Sorry.
That's my favorite thing.
Hot on the trigger.
My favorite thing.
I was just going to say, it kind of goes back to Jeff's point about the hand picks. It's not creative. It's dumbing it down instead of being more thoughtful about how you present yourself.
It's low.
Like, there's plenty of places to look at half-naked women. Like, you don't have to do it with your knife.
Yeah, and there's plenty of women who make knives too, you know?
I'm gonna tell you something. I might not 100% agree with you. I might be a little for it. You know, a little clever,
wait,
a little clever.
Naked women.
I mean, not for it 100%. I'm not 100%, but I mean, not 100% for it, but a little bit. I mean, come on, we'll live a little. You know, this is Instagram here. How about a little? You know, we gotta be. We're gonna have to wear burkas all the time. We'll take, you know, if you want to be in your swimsuit, you know. So bad about that.
We don't want to see any pics of you in a swimsuit, Jeff.
Oh, that's not going to happen. All right. This is a personal beef, and I'm going to put somebody on blast. This happened to me recently, and it infuriated me. As you know, I was in the art world for a little bit. I actually dealt with galleries. I dealt with museums. I dealt with art dealers. I dealt with a lot of artists. So I recently got someone slipped into my DMs. And they said, "Hi, I'm so-and-so, and this, you know, so-and-so, the gallerist from the whatchamacallit gallery told me to contact you. I'd like to come into your shop and forge some sculpture for an upcoming show." So at first I was immediately irritated, and then I decided, well, let me look at this guy's work. So I go to his Instagram page, and there, all to behold, are piles of expandable foam, urinal cakes, a little bit of rebar here and there. And I'm starting to get furious because this isn't a blacksmith. This isn't even a sculptor. So as I usually do when I'm irritated, I'll forward it to my buddy John Ariane, Sunset Forge, and say, "What do you think of this?" And he starts laughing, and I'm starting to get irritated. I'm getting irritated.
Love that guy.
I'm getting irritated for this reason. These goddamn gallerists, they think that so basically I got angry, and then I decided I'm going to write this guy back. And I had to think about what I was going to say, and I wrote back, "Hey man, I don't think it's going to work." And he's, "Well, why not?" And I'm like, "Well, I've seen your work and I don't think it's going to happen." And he said, "I don't understand what you mean." And he said, "Well, you know, this particular gallerist said that you'd be receptive to me coming in." And I wrote to him, I'm like, "Look, man, this expandable foam and urinal cakes ain't going to work over here at Fader Knives. This is a business. This is a business, number one. I'm a business person. This isn't a maker space. This isn't," I said, and "number two, this ain't happening. Your work ain't happening. I'm not opening my shop up to you." Now, if you were Peter Braspinix, Fire Forge, if you were Pat Quinn, if you were Sunset Forge, I'm opening up my door and I'm giving you the keys and I'm leaving. You can have my shop. But this motherfucker here, and I don't know him, he might be a perfectly nice guy, but he just thinks that just because he's maybe, you know, bent a little rebar, he thinks I'm going to shut everything down so he can work on his shitty sculptures in my shop. Well, guess what, dude? It's not happening. And you know what? It's not really even his fault. It's the fault of these cocksucker. Sorry about that, but that's true. I'm getting mad. My phone's about to pass out. It's up to these goddamn these gallerists
they don't know shit about sculpture. And what happens is they get fired up and they try to dangle some carrot in front of someone's face. So don't worry, I got the keys to Fader's shop. You can use his shop. No, no, you can't. So if you're going to slip into my DMs and ask to use my shop, or better yet, ask to visit my shop, guess what? I'm looking at your shit. And if it ain't happening, I'm just going to write, I don't think I can do it, man. It ain't happening. So I'm telling you this with peace and love. You can't use my shop. I don't like you. You're an artist that I don't like you, and I don't like the art world, and I don't like gallerists, and I don't even like myself. So that's where we're at. So there you go. That's my beef. I was really fucking pissed off, too. This guy, we're talking, I'm not kidding when I said expandable foam and urinal cakes. That ain't sculpture. That's a horse shit. There's no horse shit in my shop. This is a real business. This is playing around.
Right.
And that's it. Now I'm going to pass out. There you go.
I can hear it's true. I can hear your heart pumping away there against the microphone.
This truly happened. And I was just like, man, listen, you're getting the wrong information from the wrong people. These gallerists, you can't use me. I'm not with you. I'm not with you at all. Leave me alone. Lose my phone number. It ain't happening. That's it. That's a beef. Real beef.
And breathe. That's good. That's good.
I'm telling you, I'm about to pass out.
I think that's a show. I think we've got a show.
Right. Bong.
So, reminder of people about knifetalk.net. We've got plenty on there. We've got the forum. We've got a guide to sort of materials, where you can get your materials and supplies, that kind of stuff. We've got the T-shirts, which are directly on knifetalk.net now. Remember that if you're going live and you're following us and we're following you, there's a chance that we may just pop into your feed. We may also occasionally just put up a little graphic saying that we're going to be going live if anybody has any questions, and it could be either of us, myself, Jeff, or Mareko.
And maybe what we'll do is we'll get stickers made. And if we go on your thing and it works out, maybe if we ever get something to send away, maybe if we go on your Instagram live and you answer a question, maybe we'll send you something.
Uh-huh.
Not a bad idea. Maybe not a bad idea. Nothing special.
And if you've got questions for us, you can record them and then stick them on your feed and just tag us. Knife Talk Podcast on
beefs
Instagram.
Too.
And your
beefs too. Send us your beefs.
It'd be great to hear beefs, actually. If people want to record their own beefs and just tag us, it'd be great to hear that.
We could have a whole beef show.
Oh, my God. That's hilarious. Love
we
it.
Could do a whole beef show.
A whole beef show.
We should think about maybe for Christmas have a proper beef show.
Very festive, Jeff. Very festive.
That's it. All right, baby. Have a beef.
That's the show. See you next week.
See you, everybody.
All right.